Hi, everybody. I'm Brittany Lewis with Forbes Breaking News. Joining me now is Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus at the University of Chicago. Charles, thanks so much for joining me.
Always my pleasure, Brittany.
We always touch base every couple of weeks talking about the upcoming election. This conversation is no different. Last night was the Wisconsin primary. Both Donald Trump and President Biden won their primary pretty handily, but there are some potential warning signs. Let's start on the Democratic side. Let's start with President Biden. 8% of the Democratic primary vote went to uninstructed, meaning it was a protest vote against President Biden. What are your thoughts on this?
I think it's an interesting issue. And as you say, it's one that affects both sides, but I think it affects them differently. There's always been a kind of non-affiliated vote in these primaries, so it's not necessarily a lot larger. I think the question is, where does it come from? My hunch is that it comes from Madison, Wisconsin, places like that. So it's going to tilt younger. And it's not just Muslim Americans, but it may be younger, more progressives. Here's the problem for President Biden. It's like the 7-10 split in bowling. You sort of have to decide, am I going to take the 7 or am I going to take the 10 or am I going to risk it all trying to get them both? The problem he has is that the progressives who are uncomfortable with him are very much on the left. But to win, and he needs to have a solid, you know, overwhelming vote in his own party, of course, in the election. But the ones he needs to win over, in addition to that base, are in the center. And the more he moves to assuage the base on the left, the more he risks the base in the center. And you can see that with policies on green energy and on the southern border and on a variety of issues where he has in effect appeased the progressives but really hurt himself in the middle. That's not the problem that Donald Trump has.
So do you think that this block of protest votes, because we did see this in other states too, do you think this is going to impact him enough where he will change his policy when it comes to Israel, when it comes to the war there in the next 8 months?
He's already trying to, in effect, play on the one hand, on the other hand, call it hot and sour soup policy. He behind the scenes, they're giving a lot of weapons to Israel, but Biden's two-state policy is really about the two states of Minnesota and Michigan, not about Israel and the Palestinians. And I think that the issue of the Israelis going into Rafah, which is this city on the very southern border with Egypt, is not something that any Israeli politician can give up to the Americans on. Now, the Israelis do have the issue of wanting to get the hostages back. But let me say something about why Rafah is a problem for the Americans and why the Israelis still want to do it. It's a problem for the Americans because there are so many civilians now crowded into Rafah, maybe 1.5 million, estimates vary. But because it's on the border with Egypt, there are a lot of tunnels that go from this Palestinian territory into Egypt. In the first year or two that the current regime in Egypt, the al-Sisi military regime, was in power, they tried to cut off transit through those tunnels, but they've stopped doing that. They may be starting to do it again because of Israeli pressure, but let me tell you why that matters to Israel. Arms from Iran can come in through those tunnels, and Hamas leaders can escape through those tunnels. Now, if arms come in, that poses two kinds of threats to what the Israelis are trying to do. One, of course, the obvious one, is that they can use those arms to attack Israeli cities in the south, which is what started the war in the first place. The other, which is less obvious, is that if Hamas is well armed, they can prevent anybody else from effectively ruling in Gaza. And that is just a no-go for the Israelis, because otherwise the war just continues forever. You've got to have somebody who can step in and rule the area. And that's not an easy problem. Mind you, and this has been forgotten by Americans, the Americans gave the Israelis advice about Gaza once before. And that was during the George W. Bush administration, when Mahmoud Abbas was elected in the West Bank as the head of Palestinian Authority. And the Americans, led by Condoleezza Rice, who I have a lot of respect for, but in this case, she strongly urged the Israelis, against their better judgment, to permit a vote in Gaza. That vote was held. And just as knowledgeable people predicted, the vote was for Hamas, not for the Palestinian Authority, in part because the Palestinian Authority was believed to be kind of old and corrupt, whereas Hamas was sort of younger and more vigorous. But of course, there's been no election in either area since then. But it was the Americans who did a lot to put Hamas, in effect, in power in Gaza. And remember, under Sharon, the very right-wing leader in Israel many years ago, all Israelis withdrew from Gaza. Some didn't want to. The settlers who were there were forcibly removed. But that area was completely given over to Hamas. They've controlled it since, whatever it is, 2006, 2008, and you can see what they've done. So the Israelis feel like they have to root out Hamas. That's the goal of the war. They have to break that organization. And the Americans, if they were to be listened to, wouldn't allow them to do that.
Rafah is a red line, according to President Biden, not according to Prime Minister Netanyahu. But President Biden has also said, although that is a red line, he said separately, America stands with Israel. He's also called for more aid to go to Gaza. So what else do you think President Biden needs to do to win over that more progressive block of voters who is voting in a protest against him?
You know, it's interesting. I'm not sure what he can do. They're already engaged in this incredible hyperbole, calling what the Israelis are doing genocide. The Israelis are trying to take out an organized terrorist group that is embedded in a civilian population. And the Israelis, they've made mistakes. The bombing of a humanitarian food delivery group this week was just awful. But that was a mistake, and those are going to happen in war. The problem is that look at what happened just this week when Israel went into a hospital. The first time that particular hospital was invaded, and there have been several by the Israelis, the Palestinians were all over, how can you invade a hospital? How can you invade a hospital? And then it turns out there are not only tunnels for the terrorists underneath the hospital, which the hospital administrators and everybody else had to know were dug there, but there were 200 Hamas fighters captured in the Al-Shifa hospital this week. So in other words, they're using these civilian structures and neighborhoods for self-protection. And if the Israelis are going, no matter how much the Biden administration tries to stop the Israelis, I think at this point, the Israelis who've been fighting since October the 7th are going to say, we're just too deeply committed. We've lost too many people. We can't live in southern Israel And now, because of the bombing by Hezbollah from southern Lebanon, we can't live in northern Israel. We really have to deal with this if we're to have a country. And I don't think that there's much that the Americans can really do to change that in fundamental ways.
So is what you're saying, aside from President Biden calling for a permanent ceasefire, there's really nothing he can do to assuage these more progressive voters who are voting against him in protest?
I think he can signal to them that he's very sympathetic to them. And I think a lot of what he's doing with respect to Israel, it is a signaling to them. But I don't, but I think it goes, when you have a UN vote in which the US abstains, the Israelis are not more persuaded by that, they're more angered by that. What I think surprised the whole world, which had seen so many protests in Israel against Netanyahu, the country seemed very divided, as America is now divided, right? But if you get a 9/11 type attack, Americans unite, right? We united. After a while, that unity breaks up. You get into a war in Afghanistan and so forth, and then people begin to break off. Time passes. But the Israelis are united, not so much around Netanyahu, but around fighting this war. And there's a war cabinet, just as there was in England during World War II. It wasn't just Churchill. Labor, led by Clement Attlee, who led the government after the war, right, when Churchill was defeated, he was in the cabinet during World War II in England. So there, that's the kind of cabinet the Israelis have now. They have big internal questions, including whether to draft the hyper-religious, the so-called Hasidim, who have never been in the military and who don't want their children to go into the military, not, I think, because they're fearful that the children will be killed, but because it's a closed community. How are you going to get them back on the farm after they've seen Paris, right? After they've gone into the military, they may leave that sect entirely. So there are big disputes in Israel, but not, I think, disputes about whether to go into Rafah, and I think what to do about Hezbollah in the north, which they won't do until they have really essentially solved the problem in the south, in Gaza.
I do now want to pivot to former President Donald Trump, who last night saw a victory in his own right, easily taking the Wisconsin primary. But Nikki Haley, who did drop out of the race last month, won 12.8% of the vote. Is this a troubling sign for the former president?
Yes. But as I mentioned before about Biden. Biden has the 7-10 split. The split for Trump is closer to two pins that are next to each other, because he needs to to pick up her votes, the Nikki Haley votes. He simply needs to appeal more to the center. But he has a different problem, I think, with many of them. There are plenty of people who won't vote, who will not vote for Trump because of what they see as either his abrasive personality, not his policy, but his abrasive personality, and what they think was a danger to democracy when he failed to acknowledge his defeat in the last election. They may not think he was guilty of the charges about taking over the Capitol on January the 6th. He was never charged with that and so forth. But they don't like the fact that he still doesn't acknowledge his defeat. Now, he's not the first one. Stacey Abrams never acknowledged that she was defeated in the Georgia gubernatorial election. But this is a president of the United States, and he is still saying that he was not defeated. And therefore, you have people who are reluctant to vote for him because they're concerned about either his personality or the continuity of democracy. And there are some people who are concerned about that on the Democratic side as well. So not just about Trump, but they're concerned about Democrats who seem to be wanting to put Trump in jail and keep him off the ballot. That doesn't look very Democratic either. So what I take from that, Brittany, is that there are deep challenges to our democracy that come from both sides, and that are probably greater right now than they have been in recent years.
So how does he win over those voters then? Because we've been covering Trump either as president or running for president since 2015, and he has been a polarizing figure for almost a decade in politics. He's not one to be known to biting his tongue at all. So how does he appeal to those more centrist voters?
He bites off other people's tongues, I think.
It would appear that way, yeah.
Yes, it certainly does. They don't even have to stick their tongue out very far for him to take a nibble. I would say the following. I'm not sure whether he has to win them back or convince them that Joe Biden is just not the right choice. It's going to be a negative campaign. And I think Biden has not only low approval, he just doesn't look like a person who physically and cognitively can make it through another 4 years. And that leaves people with the possibility that they would really be voting for Kamala Harris for president. And boy, do they not want to do that.
This has been what many have called a negative campaign on both sides. How then do you see this playing out? Because it seems like both Trump and Biden are not laying out what their second term would look like. They're instead saying, vote for me, I'm better than that guy. So what does a second term look like for both Biden and Trump? Have they made any policy? Have they laid out their policy at all?
It's a really interesting question. Let me go back to how you can position a negative campaign in a positive way. I've been many years friend of David Axelrod. And David, I thought, ran the most brilliant campaign in the first Biden, in the first Obama election. Hope and change. Absolutely vacuous. Meant nothing, right? It was really vote those bums out who've been in power, George W. Bush and that sort of, don't vote for John McCain. But let's call it hope and change. I would say that the best argument that Trump could make in that regard is really the old Ronald Reagan argument against Michael Dukakis, which is, are you better off now than you were 4 years ago? And who among us would say we're better off? Not a lot. I mean, that's what the polls say. So I would say that what Trump will, what he'll say is, I'm going to secure the southern border and I'm going to stop all this illegal immigration from having people who run rampant in the streets and burn down buildings and hijack cars. And he'll run a law and order kind of campaign, and he'll probably talk about how during his time in office, inflation was low and employment was very high and real incomes were going up. And that's been a problem. But the employment has been high, but people still really feel the effects of inflation, which is disconcerting. But they also recognize that they can't buy as much as they could 4 years ago. That means their real incomes have gone down. I think on the Biden side, I've looked at the polls when they say, what do you think is Biden's biggest achievement? The majority answer is nobody can answer that. I'm not kidding. They literally say they can't They have no. And then his second greatest achievement is that he's not Trump. That's honest to goodness true. So I think what he'll run on is Trump's a danger to democracy and Trump is a danger to women on the abortion issue. They're going to run very hard on abortion. And I think they've been surprised, really, at how strong the pushback has been on illegal immigration among two groups that they really count on, African Americans and Hispanics. And they, especially African American men, are really departing from the Democratic Party. And in places like Chicago, and I'm sure this is true, and you can see it in New York too, there's a lot of anger about, you know, Mayor Adams in New York giving illegal immigrants $10,000 cash cards, and African Americans who are poor are saying, hey, where's my cash card?
Immigration definitely is one of those top issues facing the country right now. And you did pose that interesting question, voters asking themselves, am I better off now than I was 4 years ago? And according to a Wall Street Journal post, it seems like voters in battleground states think they were better off 4 years ago, because according to this new poll, in a head-to-head matchup between Trump and Biden, Trump is winning in Arizona, Michigan, Georgia, Nevada, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania, and tied with Biden in Wisconsin. So, Charles, read the tea leaves here. What do you think this all means?
First of all, I think it means the election is still a long way away. And let's say a few things about polling. Polling right now would phone you or phone me and say, Brittany, are you a registered voter? And you would say, yes, I'm a registered voter. And then they would, if you said no, then they would say, thank you, Brittany, and that would be the end of the interview. If you said, yes, I'm a registered voter, they would take your opinion. After Labor Day, they would ask you, are you a registered voter? You'd say yes. And then they'd say, Brittany, do you think you're likely to vote? If you said yes, they would continue the interview. If you said no, they wouldn't, because they only want likely voters. Why don't they ask you that now? And the answer is because you don't know if you're likely to vote. If you're really very engaged, you know, with one party or the other, somebody like you who's a political interviewer, of course you're going to vote. But most people don't really know. So there's more uncertainty in the polls. Secondly, a lot of things can happen. The biggest danger to the Trump campaign is that the economy keeps doing well. Maybe interest rates come down a little bit, but the economy is picking up a little bit. There's always a chance that Trump will make some blunder. There's always a chance that Biden will fall down the stairs. Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana said most Americans now think they could roast a turkey in the time it takes for Joe Biden to walk across the stage. And I think that, you know, that's not a good look, right? I think the biggest danger is one would be another killing by an illegal immigrant like the one of Lakin Riley in Georgia on a campus, especially if that's a criminal who had been picked up before and somehow let out, but was an illegal. And the worst of all would be a mass terror attack by somebody who had come across the border, one of the 600,000 or 700,000 people who've come across and gotten away, and those people plan some kind of an attack. And the immediate effect for the first week and a half would be rally around the flag. But after that, people would say, how the heck did this person get into the country? How did we miss this? And so I think there are a lot of potential problems like that. And of course, if the war in Gaza ends, to go back to our first question, that will ease some of the pressure from Muslims and maybe progressives on Joe Biden. That will help him. If the war is continuing, that will hurt him. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and I think we should recognize that. The polls have been wrongly accused of not being very accurate. They're actually been pretty accurate. The problem is when you have 4 million votes and 11,000 votes separate them, no poll, no matter how accurate, is going to be able to predict which side will win in that case. You just, it's just asking too much of them. If the if they are separated by 10,000, by 30, 50,000 votes, then maybe the poll will be accurate. But we're a long way away. All of these states that you quoted, I think almost all of them are within 5 points still. I would say that this is a race that's still up in the air. And as I think we've both been suggesting, Brittany, it's more a question of who will lose rather than who will win.
And like you said, I mean, we are 7-8 months out from Election Day. There could be many black swan events that happen that could shake up the nature of this entire race. And I know that as those come along, I hope that you can come along on this program and join me and break them down. But before I let you go, I would be remiss if I didn't ask about some potential chaos in the House. And after a vote on a $1.2 trillion spending package, Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene filed a motion to oust House Speaker Mike Johnson. And this comes just months after that really messy ouster of former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. What do you make of this?
There's a phrase that we used growing up in the South, dumber than a box of rocks. This is dumber than a box of rocks. You control one house of a two-chamber legislature, and you don't control the White House. You control the one house by two or three votes, and you decide, yes, I have the leverage to block. I have the leverage to block. But that's going to be true of any coherent group of three people, maybe two people. You and I, if we were representatives, could say to Mike Johnson, if you don't vote for the Brittany Amendment, which tells everybody to buy a beautiful pink jacket, then we're just not going to vote for you. And that would be enough to do him in. So you've got essentially lots and lots of potential veto groups. Yes, she could blow things up. One of the things that we learn, it may seem very different to think about the riots, the Black Lives Matter riots in the summer of 2020 after the George Floyd killing. But it's a lot easier to tear things down than to build them up. A lot easier. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, who nobody has ever considered a fountain of good judgment, has now sort of laid down a marker. Now, she has not said that she's going to bring it to a vote. She's just decided to sort of light a fire under Speaker Johnson. But I don't see how she could possibly get a speaker who was more favorable to her ideological position than him. It's just chaos, and it makes the Republicans look bad, and they know it. They have a real chance of winning the Senate, but they could blow the House.
What do you think this says, then, about the current state of the GOP, that just a few people on the right, usually they're far right, more firebrands in their party, are essentially trying to hold Speaker Johnson hostage here? I mean, we saw this play out in the fall. We're seeing it play out again. Speaker Johnson is more conservative than Kevin McCarthy, seemingly. So what does this all mean for the state of the Republican Party?
One of the things it tells me is how competent Nancy Pelosi was in running her party. She didn't have a large majority. She had only three or four votes. But you never saw AOC and the squad breaking off from key votes.
She especially was in public. Wasn't this sense of public breaking off in the party, going against your party.
She would have neutered them. She would have cut them off at the knees, if not higher. they would have looked like that Black Knight in Monty Python and the Holy Grail. They would have kept saying it's merely a flesh wound, but they'd be bleeding to death. The problem is it's been harder to do that among among Republicans. And they have a smaller majority. And you can see how bad it is because people like, I've never seen this before, where you have people like Kevin McCarthy resign, not just resign the speakership, get out of the House. And you just had that with Mike Gallagher from Wisconsin and so forth. You have people just leaving the body because they just think it's a Sisyphean task. They're pushing rocks up a hill, but the rock keeps rolling back down the hill. And I think that sensible people in the party would say that the single most important thing that we have to do is show that if you hand us the power, we will be able to govern in a way that benefits you, the American people. And I think that the Republicans have not been able to do that in the House. I think that Donald Trump is in a much better position to do that in running for president.
Well, Charles, we will leave that there. Once again, thank you so much for that wide-ranging conversation. I enjoy it every time, and I'm already looking forward to our next one.